Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher, and my guest today is Seamus Kirst. He's the author of a new memoir about growing up dealing with substance abuse, mental illness, and issues with sexual identity, and how all those intersect. The book's blunt title, I can't say on the air, I've been told, but the second half of the title is Faced. He currently works as the assistant to the social comedian W. Kamau Bell and has written for a number of periodicals and news outlets. Seamus, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Now, your book raises some broader social questions, including, as I just mentioned, the intersections of drug and alcohol abuse, mental illness, sexual identity in teens and young adults. And I want to get into some of those. But first, though, I wanted to talk to you about some more personal questions directly about the book, if I could. And I'm going to take my cue from your book itself, which is very unvarnished in its descriptions of your life. And I want to start with the foreword, actually, written by your father, Sean Kirst. It's a name that many of our listeners will know from his time at the Post Standard and his other writings. And he's been a guest several times on this program. His foreword is equally unvarnished and revealing about his relationship with you and his own addiction to alcohol and his family upbringing. So I was very curious to hear how that process played out, the conversations and the decisions between the two of you about putting together the book and the inclusion of the foreword. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. So the foreword actually happened almost right before publishing, and I kind of asked my dad to do it pretty last minute. But throughout my writing the book, he was like extremely helpful with giving me very honest feedback and with editing. So we didn't really talk about what his tone would be. And if anything, he actually seemed a little bit surprised when I asked him to write the foreword. And I think historically, he talks about his sobriety like with his friends and people he's very close to, but he hasn't written about it as publicly as I have.
I can't remember any writing in that vein of his prior to reading that foreword, yeah.
Right, and it really makes you kind of want him to write something like that and dive deeper into that. I mean, I know I personally love to read that. But so, yeah, I think he kind of, to be honest, just took the cue from reading my book and I think kind of realized that if he did write something that was maybe too reserved, it wouldn't really fit with the rest of the book. So his writing did kind of come across in a very similar, like, bare it all vein. But I think when you're writing about substance abuse and, you know, mental health issues in general, that it's kind of a situation where you have to go big or go home, because doing it halfway doesn't really help anyone.
Was there anything that your father wrote in that foreword that you didn't already know?
No. I think, though, that growing up, and I think he stopped drinking when I was like 11. So, and as he talks about it, his ending drinking kind of coincided with me starting.
Yeah.
And I think in that sense, I always kind of rejected his story. And when he would try to talk to me about it, it was very much don't project your experiences onto me. So it was really nice to now read his experiences, having gone through mine and being able to relate to them. I think how he wanted me to be able to when I was a teenager, but totally, you know, rejected it.
Now, on to your part of the story. It's a very raw and at times visceral account of you growing up and becoming an adult and your time in college. And as a parent, I have to say it made me very anxious just reading it. I mean, worrying for you as I was reading and thinking about my own child. Did you have one main purpose in writing it?
Yeah, so I think my purpose in writing it was, I guess, was kind of twofold, because I think part of it was to give a voice to people who have had similar experiences, who maybe aren't comfortable writing about it or even talking about it, or maybe even haven't reached the point yet where they realize that they have a substance abuse issue or have a mental health issue or are struggling with their sexuality. And then I think the other prong to that approach was getting people who don't have those issues to kind of better understand what people are going through. Because I think it really is easy to not understand these types of things. And that's kind of the power of a personal narrative sometimes, is that someone's able to look at your story and understand like a broader issue based on just your personal experience. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of why the more you bear in the long run, the more beneficial it is, even if some people might not understand that. And
I want to try to broaden that, actually, a little bit later, but let me stick with this for a minute. So also, and you talk about this at the beginning of the book itself, the story of how the book became a book is interesting. Could you share a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I, after graduating from college, even after becoming sober, was like dead set on becoming a lawyer and even thought about eventually wanting to be a politician. So I think I was kind of in a way reserved about my issues. And even throughout college, I'd kind of like spent a lot of time like lying about them or covering them up to kind of set myself up to have a career that was maybe more public official-esque. So then after a year of working in the nonprofit sector and then deciding that I wanted to be a journalist and like particularly a broadcast journalist. And again, kind of having this thought process of like, I don't want to bear it all because I want to, whatever, be palatable or be somebody that like a news network would hire. I then kind of just had this moment where I was like, had been thinking about this for a long time in the back of my head. And I was like, I think it's kind of time to write about this. And so when I did, I got this hugely positive reaction and a ton of people shared.
And you wrote it as a blog, right?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah. I wrote it as a blog essay and just, you know, on this like blog that I'd barely used. And it just got like thousands and thousands of views. And people were messaging me the first day being like, oh, you know, random, my like cousin who I barely speak to in Wisconsin or Montana just shared this. And I think the coolest part about that, though, was that a lot of people reached out to me who were suffering from substance abuse or who had had mental health issues. And then a ton of people reached out to me who hadn't, but still identified in some way with the narrative or identified with like, you know, I think everybody has moments where they're a little bit self-destructive. And so that was really the inspiration for writing a bigger book.
Well, you mentioned thinking about being a politician. I mean, in one sense, you could say, hey, look, you've set yourself up perfectly because there's nothing anyone's going to have on you. You put it out there already.
I know. I have thought about that before. It's, yeah, in a way, it's empowering because people can't really dig.
Right. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Seamus Kirst, a Syracuse native who's recently written a memoir about his struggles with addiction, sexual identity, and mental illness. Well, let me push you a little bit on that issue of writing all these things and putting these things out, because they are incredibly personal, and some of them, again, are hard to read. And anyone who picks up the book is going to find these things. Was that something that you had to process in a way or work through or get comfortable with? I mean, I know you wrote that early essay, but to put that all in a book and push it out like that.
Yeah, I think when I go back and read that first essay, which is in the introduction to the book, that essay was so it was very impulsive when I wrote it. And I think because I wrote it so impulsively and kind of on a whim, I was very blunt in that. And in a lot of ways, even though the book has longer descriptions about certain traumatic events, that initial essay is like pretty jarring and kind of throws it all out there, even if it's in a more broad sense. So I think that kind of by like starting with that, the rest was not. Once that was out there, it was out there and a lot of people had seen it. It like wound up being republished in like Taiwan and India. So it literally like kind of went around the world. And, you know, once something's on the internet, it's not going away. So I kind of had already like pulled the cord. Mm-hmm. So at that point, it really wasn't that scary. So I think the scariest part was the initial essay. Mm-hmm. And then once that happened, it was like,
What was the hardest part of the book for you to write?
I think in a lot of ways, I think when you're writing about your own experiences, the hardest part is finding the balance in how you depict other people and how much of their story to tell. Mm. So like, obviously there were parts that were really hard to write about, like behaviors that I'd had, but I've, you know, been to a lot of therapy, have like spent time in rehab, inpatient and outpatient. So I've kind of had time to like parse through my own experiences, which what was much more challenging was like deciding how much to write about my family, deciding how much to write about my friends, figuring out like exes, especially, figuring out how to depict them and how much is appropriate to disguise them. And so that part was definitely challenging, and you don't want people to be mad at you, but at this, and you don't want people to feel like their privacy was violated, but at the same time, you want to tell the story holistically and being honest about other people as part of that process. And I think that at a certain point I was tried my hardest to not gratuitously put anything that would hurt somebody else, but I also kind of accepted that if people were upset by it, that that was justifiable and they had the right to be, but that I felt that the benefits of writing the book outweighed them being mad.
Yeah, that's always an issue with memoirs, is how other people are going to react when they're in the book. Did you get any of that kind of reaction or pushback from people that could recognize themselves in this and didn't like the way that you had portrayed what happened?
Yeah, so I didn't really get a ton of negative feedback. I think a few people, when they read it initially, it's definitely jarring, I think, to see yourself being depicted, whether their real names are used or not.
Sure. And they know that the friends know who you're talking about. It's kind
right.
of that kind of thing, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think that, a few people were a little bit upset, but I kind of understood. And I was like, you know what? At first, obviously, you want to be defensive because it's like your work. But then at the same time, I was like, if, you know, somebody in my family wrote a book that depicted me, or if one of my friends wrote a book that depicted me, I think I too would have a moment, even if I felt like what they wrote was true and fair, where it's just jarring to see yourself on the page. And then I tried to just reach out to people and email them and tell them that it was going to happen, even people who I haven't spoken to in a long time, just to give them a heads up.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Syracuse native Seamus Kirst. He's written a memoir about his struggles with alcohol, drugs, sexual identity, and mental illness. Now, if I understand it correctly, your experiences and also the process of writing this book have led you to look into a little bit and think more deeply about some of the broader social issues that come up with your experiences. And one of those is this intersection, as I just mentioned, of struggles with the LGBTQ population and substance abuse and suicide. Mm-hmm. So tell me what you think you've learned about how those things interact.
Yeah, so I recently actually wrote an essay for the website The Mighty about that, which is a website that focuses on mental health issues. And, even as somebody who went through those experiences, I think looking at statistics about it was still, you know, really eye-opening. Like the Trevor Project, a nonprofit that works with LGBTQ youth, specifically focusing on suicide prevention, has like a ton of statistics about it. And it's like LGBTQ youth are 4 times as likely to try to commit suicide. And then like the likelihood of that attempt actually inflicting harm is way higher as well. Mm. And then I remember seeing something recently that like 30% of the LGBTQ population struggles with substance abuse as compared to 10% of the general population. That's really crazy to just see how much more all these issues affect the LGBTQ population. And it really kind of like reinforces my belief in why it was important to write about this and hopefully give voice to people who are going through similar things, who feel very isolated and who resort to self-destructive behaviors because of that sense of isolation.
Mm. And you also talk in your book about your struggles with eating disorders as well.
Yes.
They pop up in the book from time to time. So how do you understand the relationship between your eating disorders and the substance abuse? How did those things work in tandem?
Yeah, I think that they're very related. And I've written a lot about eating disorders recently too. But I think that it's kind of just a coping mechanism for dealing with, you know, stress or like a feeling of being out of control. And I think that my drinking was kind of like that too. And I think when you feel a little bit like you're in free fall in life, clinging on to an addiction, whether it's a sex addiction or a gambling addiction or a substance abuse addiction or an eating disorder, is kind of a way that you feel like you're coping with it, but what you're really doing is just like putting all of your energy into this thing that allows you to kind of avoid the real issues that you need to be dealing with.
One of the reactions that your book left me with after I was done was kind of a what now mm-hmm. kind of response. And let me clarify that in 2 ways and ask you to reflect on it. The first is, what can parents and teens and young adults reading this learn about the best way to be with a child or to be with a friend who's struggling with these things? What should they do?
Yeah, so I think that's like that's probably the question I get asked the most, and I think it's one of the hardest questions to answer. So I guess my hope in writing it was that I think in order to decide to stop drinking or abusing drugs or whatever, ending any self-destructive behavior, you really have to go through this process on your own where you reach a point. Because addiction kind of makes you focus on yourself. It's hard to, like, look beyond yourself when you're in the throes of addiction. So you really have to reach a point where you're like, I'm not happy anymore. Like, this isn't working for me. Because I think no matter how many people tell you, like, you're hurting me, blah, 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 you kind of are able to convince yourself of anything and you are able to, like, continue the addiction. So what I hope to do is kind of, like, lay out that whole process for myself in hopes that people would read it and then be able to maybe skip having to go through that all themselves. But I think that in terms of like a friend or a parent, I think you kind of, I don't know, I hate the phrase tough love. And I think that like tough love is sometimes too extreme. But I think that you need to like have real consequences and like you have to look at maybe ways that you're enabling behaviors and just be tough in that sense and be honest and yeah, I think just like don't sugarcoat someone else's behavior to them because if you give an inch, they'll take a mile.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is the writer, Seamus Kirst. Well, the second of these what now type of questions is much broader. It's at the public policy level. Do you have thoughts about the best way for us as a society and working through the levers of public policy to address substance abuse? I mean, the nation continues to debate treatment versus punishment, addressing demand versus supply, whether or not it even makes sense to talk about something called a war on drugs. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and really quickly going back to the last question,
sure.
The other thing I just want to put out is get mental health professionals involved.
Okay.
I feel irresponsible not saying that. But going to the point of broader public policy, I just am completely in opposition to the war on drugs. I think that the criminalizing of using drugs is like not benefiting anyone. And when you look at the numbers, it's like the U.S. has spent trillions of dollars on the war on drugs. I was just looking at a chart yesterday, actually, where the amount of spending has just like, you know, skyrocketed and the levels of addiction across the population are pretty much the exact same as they've been since the beginning of the war on drugs. So clearly that's not working. And I think that drug abuse and drug use are more of a health issue than a criminal issue. And I think until we start treating it as such, we're not going to make any progress. And I think that like if somebody is using drugs, throwing them in prison is probably the last thing, not probably, is the last thing they need. And is only going to make it worse because then also now they have a criminal record and it's going to be harder for them to get a job or get into school or whatever. So you're just kind of like perpetuating.
And I want to drill it down even more specifically from there because a lot of the book is about drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are other drugs involved clearly and there's addictions there as well, but it seems like drinking is at the heart
mm-hmm.
of it. When I grew up and went to college, the legal drinking age was 18.
Right.
And it's been 21 for a while now. Do you have any thoughts about the legal drinking age as it relates to these problems?
I do. I don't agree with the legal drinking age being 21. And I know a lot of people don't, but I also know it's a really, like, hot button issue and that people feel very strongly about it in both ways. And I know, like, for instance, Mothers Against Drunk Driving are really – as a whole organization are very much for the 21 mm-hmm. drinking age. And I agree with a lot of what they do in fighting against drunk driving, but I don't agree with that specific part of the mission. I think that it's really kind of bolstered this binge drinking culture because people kind of have to drink. There's always like a sense of secrecy now that shrouds teenage drinking. And I don't know, I feel like there are a lot of other issues too. Like teenagers drink, and teenagers are going to drink. They always have, and I think they always will. So it's like, do we want to have laws that make it so a large portion of teenagers are kind of, like, disregarding the law and, like, learning and sneaking around and lying to their parents? Or do you want to have a more European approach or approach of like most of the world where it's kind of just, you know, your teenagers can drink in the house. You can model appropriate drinking behavior. They're not lying to you. If they're at a party and they like want to come home, they feel comfortable telling you. If one of their friends drinks too much, they feel comfortable calling the police instead of being afraid that they'll get into legal trouble for calling the police, which with like Good Samaritan laws and stuff doesn't happen. But I think there's a lot of misinformation surrounding that. And I think a lot of that would go away if we just made the drinking age like 16 or 18.
You know, we just have a couple minutes left, but I want to go back to your personal story and actually go back to the beginning of our conversation where I also asked you about your father's foreword. It has to do with the decision to stop. Mm-hmm. And you talked a little bit about this just a few minutes ago, but it seemed to me in reading both the accounts of your father's foreword and your account of your decisions to stop, it wasn't this big dramatic event. Mm-hmm. It was rather mundane, really, in comparison to the other things that are described in there. So you're almost feeling like when you're reading this book, when is this guy going to stop doing this? And it's going to be this thing I can't even imagine based on what I've already read. Right. But when you get to the point where you stop, it actually was kind of, you know, okay, you just realized, as you just said, I'm not happy with this life. I wonder if you could reflect a little more on that, because it was one of the things that surprised me the most in reading the book.
Yeah, and I think it surprised me the most in, like, kind of living this life that it just – one morning I just woke up and literally just kind of, like, was like, I don't remember what happened last night, and was, like, doing the thing I'd done 100 times where I was going through my texts and, like, trying to piece it together and calling my friends and being like, was I mean to you? Sorry. And I just felt really horrible. And – but yeah, it was so weird that it kind of was just a situation of like the straw that broke the camel's back. And it's like there'd been like bricks thrown on the camel's back. And all of a sudden it was just that final straw that was like, this is too much. And I think like there were like more intense dynamics within that mundane moment. Like I think that I just realized like I really am going to die soon because I just keep not remembering what's happening. And, you know, like 98% of the time that's fine, but then there are like these other times where I'm doing really, really crazy things that I could get like hit by a car or like hurt by someone else, and I think the other really scary thing was that I was doing behaviors that were hurting myself when I was drunk. So I think there were like those deeper dynamics within it, but the moment itself was pretty mundane and definitely not where I thought my drinking career would end.
That was Seamus Kirst. Again, I can't say his book's title on the air, but the second half is Faced, and I think that and his name is enough for you to find it online. Seamus, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest. For an addition to the conversation you've just heard, please go to WRVO.org, and please tune in again to WRVO Public Media for more Campbell Conversations.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.